We're thinking about the birth of Jesus and the kings from the east paying homage to him. And I hope I'm not offside saying this. I'm trying to carefully think about what I want to share this morning. Sometimes it's a little too much. You can go anywhere. This morning, as Aurora and I were sort of catching up and talking about the different incarnations of Christianity, especially when we contended into the incarnation of Christianity in the American context with all its problematic tones. It's important to recognize that the birth of Jesus is a political act. So all the readings we heard today are reading the Psalms, the people of God asking for justice to come, not just to a personal justice of their personal injury, but a justice to the nations, of oppression of the nations being lifted. And hearing Isaiah say that one day there will be one who will do that, who will bring the light. And of course, a gospel reading is meant to point us to that one. Jesus, born in a manger. So here's the uncomplicated bit. Yet it's important to focus on the hope that comes in Jesus. Because Jesus being born in a manger, God coming to us as a human being, upends everything we know of what will make sense in this world. Because in this world, what makes sense is those who have power, those who have maybe undue influence, can shape the world as they see fit. And if you don't bow to them, you're crushed. That's the history of the world. And that's been our history. And yet when God chooses to finally reveal God's self in a perfect way, God doesn't come down with divine armor, a divine train of warriors. God comes small, vulnerable, a child. And in the birth of Jesus, the modes of power and oppression in this world are made obsolete. They're on an egg timer. Right? Violence doesn't have its last word. Suffering and death, though real, I don't want to pretend they're not, in the birth of Jesus are made temporary. That's a political act. Born, Jesus born, defies it. Okay. That sounds good. I don't think anyone's going to object to that. That Herod, with his might, seeking out Jesus, he's part of the obsolete reality of power. Okay, we can agree with that. And yet we have these kings. What does their reality have to say to us? Now, thinking that here, Banff, here in the Bow Valley, to say that power and oppression are bad is not a complicated thing to say. I think we largely agree to that. Maybe in other places in the world that would be complicated, but here, not so much. So it's great. Jesus being born, evil, bad, great. But there's something else that's happening here that I think we would have to contend with. We'll see what you think. Because in our culture, maybe not only locally, but actually, let's say the Western mode of being is something like this. We have a view that puts politics and political arrangement as a centerpiece of how we understand ourselves and how we explain ourselves, right? My morality, whatever I believe, is mediated by the politics that I adhere to, maybe even proclaim, right? Political infrastructure is what dominates maybe my existential gaze, how I see myself, how I see the world around me is the framework is politics. I want to be careful because I don't want to say that politics don't matter. That's never. So in case you think that in the next 5 minutes, I'm telling you right now, that's not what I'm saying. We have to be careful. Politics are very important because it's how we arrange ourselves socially and how we protect, ideally, the weakest among us. So politics are important. But what the Bible reading is showing us today is that political arrangements cannot be the center of how we experience ourselves as humans. They cannot be the center of our how we express ourselves morally or ethically. They can't be central to our self-understanding. Not too long ago, as maybe you did too, you know, with we had all the snow and it was so freezing, but then it got nice again and it kind of melted a little bit. And now if you walk out, there's these pockets of like ice that you have to be careful about. And there was this moment where it wasn't a serious fall, but like there was these three slips. And each one slipped backwards maybe, and one that was a little bit side. And eventually when I tumbled, it was kind of like a knee thing. I'm okay. But I was talking to Britt, you know, reflecting on that. The reality is that there's so many ways to trip up. Really. Maybe you've tripped up, tripped so many times in my life, and they're all a unique little story if you were interesting. On how I fell, how I hurt myself. But when it comes to the human condition, humans are incredibly boring with how we trip. It's like we always fall in the same way. We always trip up and fall in the same way. It's always, oh, I want to do some good, however that good's understood. Let me accrue power. Let me rise the ranks and deploy my version of good. It ends up in some kind of oppression. Right? Take any government in history that we've labeled and recognized as oppressive, and they have that narrative. And of course, they're the Star Wars, they're the rebels, they're the little guns. And they want to do right, and they fight the Empire, and they establish themselves as the true goodness. And they, so boring, so chronic, they trip. And they become the new Empire over and over again. Unlike a tripping on the ice, human history is extremely boring. It feels so repetitive. Rise up, take power, use that power to do good, ends up being oppression, taking down, new system, try to do some good, becomes oppression, take that down, ad nauseam. Right? And the risk we run is if we internalize a political view, like the notion of looking at things politically, and we put that at the center of our hearts, we're like inculcating in ourselves an eternal tripping. Right? Because the people that you, either you'll enter politics and then you'll damage your soul, or you're gonna champion for people who are in politics, and eventually, because they're human beings, they're gonna let you down. They're gonna say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. So you'll either go down with them, or you'll choose someone else, and you'll be choosing the whole rest of your life in a kind of a flux. Which is why I think that the kings from the East are so helpful. Because here, the tradition goes, and here we're leaning on, you know, thousands of tradition. The Bible actually didn't say there's three wise men. There's many. It could have been, for all we know, there have been 50 of them. But we typically use three. And this is not just the story. We'll see the meaning behind that. But what are the names? Do you guys know the names? Balthazar, Caspar, Melchior, I think. Ah. These are the three. And they're meant to represent, one is from Europe, one is from the continent of Asia, one's from the continent of Africa. You see in the paintings, and that's how they're painted. The idea was, behind that those paintings, is that the nations of the known world at that time are coming, the kings of these worlds are coming to Jesus, the newborn king, right? And they're all coming to see the light. And that's what we're seeing. What we're meant to see in these three wise men, these kings, people who have achieved apex of political influence and power. How much higher could you get than a king when it comes to the political plays of our world? They're the top. They're the senator, the congressman, the president. They've achieved. And yet, they see a star. something beyond my political gaze. And wonderfully to follow it. And there they arrive. And they're still working it out. Because when they arrive to Israel, to Jerusalem, they're thinking the way that politics think. They go to the king. Of course, the new royalty must be born in the halls of power. And they show up. And Herod is made nervous by this. His machinations to get a hold of Jesus. He lies to the wise men. The wise men don't pick up on that. But the wise men don't stay at the halls of power. They realize, no, this isn't it. This isn't where the king of the world is. And they move on. And eventually they find Jesus in Bethlehem, Judea, in the manger. And it says that when they arrived there, they brought gifts of gold, incense, and myrrh. Right? And it says that they worship him. We stand, we sit in our worship. Maybe some of you will kneel when we pray. But in the ancient mode of worship, we're talking about like kneels all the way down in prostration. In fact, when you're ordained, you usually lay down flat on the ground at the cross. The flatness. Because worship means I'm not here to stand as an equal to you, but I'm going all the way down. An ancient mode. We don't do that today. I'm not knocking what we do. I'm just saying, think of the kings doing something like that. Kings were used to people bowing to them or themselves doing this, going all the way down. They're worshiping. That's a very important word because they're not entering in philosophical dialogue with, hey, let's talk as peers. They're not entering in political dialogue with this new king. They're not making deals, political deals. They're not plotting out betrothals. They're not doing any of that. They're worshiping. And it's that worship that they've recognized is to be central to the way we experience our humanity. Not politics, not the spirit of the age, worship. Because in the world, you know what worship is? Worship is the recognition of the transcendent other, that is God, the divine. Worship is recognizing the other and recognizing, when you see the other, that the human, me, have limits. And I cannot solve the problems of this age. I learned something this week. The part of me wishes I didn't learn. But now knowing it, I can't not tell you. Here we are. It was this video. Maybe you've seen it. It's this video of these mines in Africa, in Gambia. Cobalt mine. I didn't realize. I didn't know what that is. It's material. And you, in the video, when you see the pan video, you see probably hundreds of mostly men, but there's also women and children. It looks like they're digging with their hands. And the reporter who's sort of clandestinely taking this video, legally by their standards, is taking it. It's a BBC program. And they're saying how this is a cobalt mine. And cobalt, I didn't know this, maybe you do, is essential for almost all the technology that we use. Phones, computer screens, anything you name it has technology in it, needs cobalt to run. Now, the major corporations, like Apple, like I have an iPhone right now, but major corporations, Google, you name it, have all signed treatises that they will not purchase cobalt from mines that employ what they call artisanal miners. That's another word, a nice word to say miners that have to use their hands. So ideally, they will only buy cobalt from other mining companies that are using, you know, paid laborers or machinery that's appropriate to that kind of work. But the report is pointing out, yeah, they signed that at the top level that the whole world sees that we will tune into the TV to see the signing. Bill signed and agreed to that, but on the ground, you know, the real politic, they're buying cobalt from these mines. That's why they exist. And then I saw that on my phone, of course, and you just feel your stomach just falls. Because what we suspect is actually real. That at the moment you become aware of the brokenness of this world, you simultaneously find yourself complicit. Trapped. And so it is the height of hubris to say, as I'm trapped in the network of sin, of oppression, and I'm participating in, you know, ignorant for a while, and then you learn, and I'm still participating. I still have my phone, by the way. screens and all that. Well, I'm caught in this web, and then it's humorous to say, but I can, with politics, with new philosophies, with new ideologies, I can get us out of this. It's just so blind. And I sense the kings of the East saw that, and they knew that. And so when they bow down, the act of worship is an act of saying, I am not the center of the universe. I'm not at the center of making this world right. I need help. And the help that I need is a baby here right now in this manger. Not my ability, not my politic, my ideology. It's this other who is both vulnerable and gentle, upending the violence of this age and of our age too, but also fully God. The divine that I need, because I can't do it on my own. Worship. Now, why are they worshiping this baby? That's an important question. I mean, I've talked about, you know, baby, God, gentle, divine. Okay, but what do they know? Well, it's very interesting that the gifts that they bring to this baby, because of course, maybe at some point in your life, you've gone to a baby shower, right? Or you give kids, you give maybe a gift to a small child, and what kind of gifts do you bring? A stuffy, a little toy, you know, a battery, a toy that parents don't put the batteries in. something for a child. But notice the kings don't do that. The wise men don't bring a little doll for Jesus, a little blanket. They bring gold, right? Myrrh. Those three gifts. Now the gold makes sense because the baby's a king. Usually, if you're a lesser king coming to the greater king, you always bring tribute. So it made sense for them to bring gold. They're saying publicly, yes, we're kings, but you are the greater king. Here's this gold. Recognition, public. But the other two gifts, I want to say, are prophetic. And I wonder how much they knew. Because the myrrh, the other two gifts that they brought, in that ancient time were used for burial of nobility and kings. And so in their worshiping of him, of Jesus, and the gifts they bring, they're highlighting for themselves, but also for the rest of the world, all history, why the worship is occurring. They're telling us. Because they bring these embalming, these spices. When the king dies, this is what you would use to bury them. And what they're pointing to us, now that we know the story, is that this baby will one day grow to be a man, and he will teach about the divine reality and God's love in a new and radical way. It's so new and radical that the powers of that time will seek to kill him. And he will be divisive. Some people will hear his voice and follow him. Others will reject it, feel weirded out by him, tell on him to the government. Eventually, he's arrested, and he's sentenced to death. Now, of course, he's God. He could always stop this. But he says himself to his followers, you know, they don't take my life. I give my life of my own accord. This baby grows up to be a man who chooses to give his life on a Roman cross. The Herods, the Roman empires, the powers of that age thought that they had vanquished them. Right? Their system, their politic of might makes right, deployed once again, worked once again, right? They captured Jesus and they killed him. The systems of the world, even at that time, had been working for thousands of years. And they did it. Clearly it worked. What they didn't know is that when they were putting the sword right through Jesus in his death, Jesus was making their power obsolete. In them deploying death, Jesus was making death obsolete. It's in a sense, in his death, he was taking their power and actually the power of death over our lives, and he was killing it. He took it in himself. We know that he killed it because when they put him in the tomb, 3 days later, he came out. not just raised back from the dead like some zombie. He was resurrected, it said. He came back with new life, with new understanding, new knowledge, new abilities he didn't have before. The slain and risen king, often called the Lamb, so gentle that no matter who you are, no matter what kind of life you've led, so gentle that if you come to him, you'll never be pushed away. You'll only be welcomed. Yet so powerful that the death that none of us in this room could ever push away, that death couldn't hold him. He is the one worthy of worship. The kings knew. He is the only one, Jesus, who we can take and put at the center of our lives, and it won't be in vain. It'll actually be exactly what we were designed and created for, to put the love of God at the center of our lives. And so we have to ask ourselves then, this is the application, what actually is at the center of my life? Because today, by virtue of the whole political thing, we talk about politics, and that could be the center of your life. When you really explain yourself, it's my political alignments that explain me, or it's my ideologies that explain me, or there could be other things. Hedonism could be the pleasure that I experience. Pleasure actually drives my life. Or if you're the family mode, oh, my kids, my family life, that's at the center of my life, right? It could be anything. And all of those things, if you put it at the center of your life, as you worship them, because the whole worshiping, we all worship. No one doesn't worship. It's just you have to choose what you worship. Any of those things will just drain your life. When you fail them, they'll just mock you, laugh at you. If it's your politics, well, the day will come when your politics will no longer be fashionable, and then you're going to be out of step, and the other people are going to shame you, and you're going to feel silly and stupid, and what are you going to do? Politics will fail you. Kids grow up, and before they leave the house, maybe by then they'll already resent you and hate you. Really, you might be a great parent. Kids will turn on you. Parents definitely can abandon you. Put that at center. Money, center, you can lose it. You name it, everything on the list, everything in the center of your life will disappear probably when you need it most. But Jesus, the gentle king, who death couldn't hold, you put Jesus at the center of your life, which means worshiping Jesus, right? No one can kill Jesus, so that's the fix. Jesus is a faithful God, so God will never leave you, so Jesus will always be there. Jesus is loving and forgiving, which means that if you have Jesus at the center of your life, you must be forgiving and loving, which doesn't mean excluding people, right? If that's at the center. See what I'm talking about here? What the king saw as they brought him his gifts and now from worship. My prayer this morning is that you see that too. But I see it. I'm talking about it here, but I'm there with you. I have to be hearing this too. All of us do. Take stock of what's at the center of your life. What are you actually worshiping? If it's not Jesus, take that out. Put Jesus in. That's the application. And then if you think to yourself, I've taken Jesus in, is it being shown in your life? Are you more loving? Are you more welcoming? Are you more forgiving? And then really that'll be shown as a two-sided coin. The forgiving, the loving, the inclusion will also be noticed by how and what you worship. Which you were here this morning. This is worship. We read the words of God. We sing our songs to him. God, I wish we knew what the angels sang, their hymns. We don't have those. We have these. They're nice. But we, you know, you hear me every Sunday. I'm not that good of a singer, but I sing my little voice, not because I'm trying to flex on you, whatever I have, because I'm trying to show God, you deserve this. And you do too. Although some of you guys are actually really good singers, so that's great. That's wonderful. All right? Do you hear this? Don't rely on your strategies. Rely on Jesus. That's epiphany. That's the light we're all meant to see. I hope that you're seeing it. I hope that you're hearing it. Anything I said that's brought you closer to Jesus, I hope that you really remember that. Anything I said here that wasn't doing that, I hope that it just falls away and you don't remember it. It's not me or what I'm saying. It's Jesus. Only Jesus was actually the light of this world. So let's pray. Gracious and loving God, we thank you that as you came to your people 2,000 years ago and you revealed your love for them, you didn't leave us Gentiles out in the darkness, kind of looking in, spectators, hoping but never receiving. You actually looked to us too and you said, you are also welcome to my family. You also belong. And Lord, we thank you that you've included us into your family. Now all that's left is for us to accept that. And maybe sometimes or often we reject that familial invitation. We want to do it our own way. God, would you help us not do that? Would you help us to trust you to put your life and love at the center of our life? Can it be evident in how we forgive others, love others, how we worship you, that we have your life and your love in our life? Can you help us do that? We thank you that as we're asking for this, that you're making it possible in Jesus because he's here with us. And he never fails. So we give you thanks and praise in his name. Amen.